First Samuel, chapter 16. Now in these four talks, I propose to look at the life of David, or more specifically, four periods in the life of David, and to consider the psalms which he wrote in each of those four periods. And I want to relate those psalms to the story of David as we have it recorded in the books of Samuel. So in other words, the four talks will be something of a coordination of the books of Samuel and Psalms, paying particular attention to the significance of the Psalms in relation to the story of David as recorded here in Samuel. Now we commence the story in 1 Samuel 16 when David first came in contact with Saul. The significant words are in verse 13, the latter half of verse 13, where it says that the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward, and in verse 14, the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. And once that happened, Saul was from that time on plagued with all sorts of moods and brooding. He was subject to certain fits. He became unstable emotionally and mentally. He became jealous. Feelings of insecurity seemed to bother him. There was anxiety and tension. And when he got these fits, his servant suggested to him, in verse 16, that he should find somebody who could play music well, and this person could soothe the king's troubled nerves when he was troubled by these weird attacks. So verse 17, Paul said, okay, go and find somebody. And in verse 18, they come up with this young man, David. And look what he is. He's a man who is skillful in playing. He's a man of valor, a man of war. He's prudent in speech, a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him. He certainly is well equipped. He is, in modern jargon, you might say, a person of much charisma. Almost anything he does well. He has tremendous natural ability. And as far as we're concerned with his psalm writing, you notice here he has great ability with words, and he also has musical ability. And those two gifts, of course, are necessary for somebody who is going to write songs or poems or psalms. And David, as we know, was the greatest psalm writer of them all. So he came into Saul's court, and soon you find, if you go to verse 21, that he became Saul's armor bearer. And when you go over to chapter 18, verse 2, he now becomes a permanent member of Saul's household. Saul would not let him return to his father's house. Now it's in chapter 18, verse 1, that we're introduced to the friendship that developed between Jonathan, Saul's son, and David. And this friendship was in great contrast to the jealousy which Saul had for David, which is going to develop as you read the story on. Jonathan made a pact with David, a covenant if you like, and he swore loyalty to David, and as a demonstration of his loyalty, he gave David certain articles of clothing, and also certain pieces of weaponry. In verse 5, David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him. And as a result, Saul set him over the men of war. So David is continuing to rise in the ranks. So much so that he has won considerable popular support. The latter half of verse 5 tells us that all the people held David in great honour. They were pleased with his exploits. Also Saul's servants. Now that's significant because you're going to find later on, particularly in the second of these talks, that Saul's servants later turned against David and were one of the weapons that Saul used in his attacks on David. So David went out, and wherever he was successful. When he came back in verse 7, we find the people celebrating his victories by saying, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. And immediately Saul is stirred to great jealousy against David. Why should he get praise for only slaying 1,000, whereas David gets the praise for 10,000? 10 times better, they're saying, David is. There's nothing like success to stir up jealousy in another person. People who may be friends, and then one of them just gets a little more successful than the other, and that old jealousy is stirred up. So on one occasion, when Saul was bothered by one of these fits, David was playing to him, and Saul, conscious of the fact that David was on the rise in his ranks, took a spear and tried to pin David to the wall with it, and David only escaped with his life very narrowly. This obviously bothered him. Why shouldn't it? If you go to chapter 19, in the opening verse there, Saul is now trying to use Jonathan, his son, and his servants, that is Saul's servants, to try to kill David. Now previously, Saul's servants were favourable to David, and Jonathan, of course, was David's friend. Now Saul is working through these two channels to seek to get back at David and to try to get rid of him. As you read the story on, you find that Jonathan remained unmoved, but not so the servants of Saul. We'll look later on at some of the methods Saul used to get them on side. In verse 2 of 19, Jonathan told David, "Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore take heed to yourself. In the morning stay in a secret place and hide yourself, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to my father about you, and if I learn anything, I'll tell you." Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, because his deeds have been of good service to you." And so Jonathan pleaded David's cause before his father, and effectively so, because in verse 6, Saul hearkened to the voice of Jonathan, and he said, "As the Lord lives, David shall not be put to death." Well, that sounds very good. David goes forth again into battle. There's war again in verse 8, and David again was successful, and yes, you've guessed it, Saul was stirred to jealousy once again at David's successes. Once again he tried to nail David to the wall with his spear, and David escaped. Saul was not content with that, and now he was determined to get rid of David, and he pursued David even to David's own house. Now, David was married to a woman called Michal, who happened to be Saul's daughter. And in verse 11 and following, you find how Michal protected David by taking an image and arranging it in the bed and arranging the pillow and the bedclothes round about it to make it look as if David was in bed. Because Saul, in verse 11, had sent some of his servants now to watch David's house and to kill him in the morning. But Michal, being aware of what was going on, helped David to escape and then put the dummy, the image, in the bed so that it tricked those who were waiting to kill him. And of course, later on they find that when they got into the house, there it was only a bundle of bedclothes. David, meanwhile, had escaped. Well, now the hunt is on. When you come to chapter 20, verse 1, David fled from Naioth in Ramah, and he came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my guilt? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" And Jonathan, who apparently was not aware of these last couple of attacks, the attack in the palace, the second attempt on David's life with a spear, and then the subsequent attack upon David at his house, Jonathan apparently was unaware of these two occasions. And Jonathan in verse 2 said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It's not so." David replied, "Your father knows well that I have found favour in your eyes, and he thinks, 'Let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death.'" Jonathan showed true loyalty to his friend and said, "Whatever you say, I will do." He believed David, and the story goes on how David and Jonathan agreed to cooperate in seeking to find out once and for all what Saul's real intentions towards David were. There was a feast. At the feast, David was absent, and Saul was there, of course, with Jonathan his son. And when he found that David was absent, we find once again his rage is kindled in verse 30. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, using an expression which seems to be rather foul and creeps into almost every language and culture of the world, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives upon the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established." And there it is, the appeal to the very basest things in human nature. If you can't get a person on side by some sort of reasonable argument or presentation of facts, just appeal to the person's selfishness, pride, ambition or something like that. Most times it will work, but it didn't with Jonathan. Saul said to him, look, David is a threat to you. As long as you let this character keep living and moving around, carrying on and achieving these great victories, as long as David's alive, your own position is threatened. Saul was aware that David was a threat to him, and he said, of course, that Jonathan should be the next king, but Jonathan, by helping David, was in effect diminishing his own chances of being king. And it just so happens that David had not plotted against Saul at all. David was not angling to get Saul off the throne. All David was doing was simply trying to preserve his own life. However, Saul's outburst at least convinced Jonathan that Saul indeed was planning evil against David. And then we have the secret plan of the firing of the arrows as some sort of secret sign to David that he should escape. And even that plan, it looks rather odd, with this firing of arrows and sending a little boy to collect them and saying it's over there or it hasn't gone far enough, that does strike us as being a little strange. But the whole point of the exercise seems to have been to keep everything secret. They wanted no rumours. They didn't want it to appear that David had anything against the king. Neither Jonathan nor David, through all these events, showed any desire to rebel against the king or to harm the king. Their sole purpose was to preserve David's life. In chapter 21, you find now that David is on the run and he goes to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And you know the story there of how, through misrepresenting the truth, he obtained weaponry and provisions. But in verse 7 we are told he was seen by a scoundrel by the name of Doeg. And you know the story later on, how that Doeg went and told Saul, and Saul in a mad rage then sent and killed pretty well all the priests that lived in Nob. Well, from there he went, and in verse, he meaning David, in verse 10, David fled now to the town of Gath, which was in the area controlled by the Philistines, and he came to Achish, the king, and Achish apparently welcomed him. We're going to meet this man Achish later on, and he doesn't impress you as being a man absolutely bursting with initiative and intelligence. He knew how to hold power, but that's about all. He was a bit thick-headed, it seems, in some of his other actions. And it took some of his servants to let him know that by harbouring David in the town, he was harbouring one who may be a threat to their security. Because after all, wasn't David the king's son-in-law? And wasn't David the one of whom they had sung, David has slain his 10,000s? And so they sought to kill David. When David got wind of this, he realized that he had put his foot in it. He now tried to escape from Gath, and the only way he could get out was to act as if he was a madman. Let spit run down his beard and scrabble around the doors and do crazy things like that. And Achish says, this man's half crazy. Haven't I got enough madmen in the town already without bringing me another one? And so they got rid of David. So with a great sigh of relief, David was off. And in chapter 22, verse 1, he comes now to the wilderness. Most of the rest of his time of running from Saul is spent in the wilderness. He comes to the cave of Adullam. And here he's joined by various members of his family and all sorts of other discontented people. Lawbreakers, people on the run, social dropouts, discontented types of one sort or another. And the latter part of verse 2 tells us that altogether there were about 400 men. And these David welded into a very effective fighting force. They moved around through the wilderness, and on occasions they helped some of the local people. For example, they came to the town of Keilah, which had been invaded by the Philistines, and David and his 400 men were able to save Keilah from the Philistines. But David got news that the people of Keilah may hand him over to Saul. Saul apparently had found out that David was hiding there in Keilah, and David consulted the Lord and said, can I trust these people to protect me? And God said, no, you can't trust them. They'll hand you over. You find that in chapter 23, verse 12. David said, will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul? And the Lord said, they will surrender. So in verse 14, David escaped from Keilah, but he remained in the strongholds in the wilderness, in the hill country of the wilderness of Ziph. And it was here that Jonathan visited him, as the next few verses tell us. but Jonathan was able to do very little. Now again, Jonathan remained loyal to his father, who was, after all, still king, and so did David. They had no reason to want to execute Saul. This was purely a personal dispute between Saul and David. In fact, it was all on one side. It was all on Saul's side. David had nothing against Saul at all. But in verse 19, worse is to come when the Ziphites, that's the people of the wilderness of Ziph where David was hiding, found out that he was there and decided they'd hand him over to the king. Now, they don't come out very well in this story. But for both the people of Keilah and the people of Ziph, we must remember that they had no reason to support David. It was not a civil war. They were still subjects of the king, and it was their responsibility to be loyal to him. And you can't really blame them for being loyal to the king. David was the one that was on the run. For all that, you can't help but despise these Ziphites in a way when they come in verse 19 and send a messenger to Saul saying, "Look, David is hiding among us in the strongholds at Horesh." Verse 20, "Now come, O king, according to all your heart's desire, to come down, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand." Real nice types. They were going to hand David over and hopefully get a reward. So David's on the run again. You then have the story of how David comes into the cave, and you know how he cut off the skirt of Saul's robe. Saul, unaware that David spared his life until David told him so later on. And the story moves on through various other escapades that David had. Now all this time David was on the run was quite a lengthy time. Sometimes reading it through we get the impression it may have been all over in a few months. Actually, it lasted for years. From the time that David came into the household of Saul as a young musician to the time that he succeeded Saul as king was something like 14 or 15 years. And for a lot of that time, it appears, David was on the run from Saul. So we're thinking in terms of quite a number of years over which these stories are spread. And during that time, David wrote many psalms. Probably David's better-known psalms come from this period. And if you can go across to the book of Psalms, we'll look at a few of them. We'll start at Psalm 52. It so happens that there are many psalms in this collection that have been given titles that indicate the circumstances in which they were written. There are many, in fact the majority, don't have titles. But even with those, many of them, it appears, were written during the time of David's flight from Saul, when he was oppressed by his enemies, he had done no wrong, and the innocent person was suffering. But there is a concentration of them between Psalms 52 and 59, and we'll just look at a few of them. We'll look at those that have a title to them. For example, Psalm 52, the instructions to the choir master are that it is a maskil of David. A maskil was a type of song or a type of poem. Just as we have narrative poems, we have ballads, we have sonnets, we have different types of poetry in English, so also did they in Hebrew. They had psalms, maskils, miktams, and they apparently were sung or played in different ways. And so the choir master is given a few instructions as to what sort of song it is so that he'll know how to conduct the singing. This one concerns Doeg the Edomite, who came and told Saul that David has come to the house of Abimelech. So in the opening verses, David in effect addresses Doeg by saying, "Why do you boast, O mighty man, of mischief done against the godly? And all the day you are plotting destruction, your tongue is like a sharp razor, you worker of treachery." Which of course is exactly what Doeg was. Then he goes on in that strain, showing how God will break him down. Psalm 54, he gives an instruction to the choir master that this one must be sung with stringed instruments. It also is a maskil, and it concerns the occasion when the Ziphites went and told Saul that David is hiding among us, the story we just referred to. "Save me, O God, by thy name, and vindicate me by thy might. Hear my prayer, O God. Give ear to the words of my mouth, for insolent men have risen against me. Ruthless men seek my life. They do not set God before them." A reference, no doubt, to Saul and his cohorts who were pursuing David, but possibly also to the Ziphites who had betrayed David. But through it all, verse 4, "God is my helper, the Lord is the upholder of my life, and he will requite my enemies with evil." And that was the theme of David through all this. He would not lift his hand against the Lord's anointed. Vengeance belonged to God, and God alone would repay. You come to Psalm 56. To the choir master, he says, this is to be sung to the tune of the dove on far-off terebinths. This one is a miktam, which is a different type of song, and it concerns the time when the Philistines seized him in Gath. As I referred to, he went to Achish and they said, here, you have a fifth columnist here. He'll no doubt work some evil against the Philistines, and David had to act as a madman in order to escape with his life. And he was afraid in verse 3, but when he was afraid, he said, I trust in God. In God whose word I praise, in God I trust without a fear. What can flesh do to me? Well, I can do quite a bit, actually. But the point is that through it all, he's going to trust in God and look to God for deliverance. And as for the things that men could do to him, he finds in verse 5 that they're certainly trying their hardest. All day long they seek to injure my cause. All their thoughts are against me for evil. There he is, David, who's slain his 10,000s, the son-in-law of the king. He's in here to spy out and to execute his evil designs against our people. And verse 6, they band themselves together. They lurk. They watch my steps. They're tailing him around the city. They're seeing where he goes, making sure that he can't work any sort of insurgency in their midst. And they wait for his life. They're waiting for the opportunity when they can kill him. But he says again, oh, recompense them, my God. Recompense them for their crime. In wrath cast down the peoples, O God. He leaves again the vindication of his right to the Lord himself. And he knows that God is aware of his situation. He can't sleep at night. Well, who could if you know that somebody is waiting outside with a dagger ready to poke in you? He tosses and turns all night, verse 8. And God, he says, knows that I toss and turn and can't sleep. And you've got my tears in a bottle, which means God is conscious of the anxiety of the tears he is shedding. God knows all this. They are all in his book. God doesn't forget. God takes note. Then my enemies will be turned back in the day when I call. This I know, he says, God is for me. And in God whose word I praise, and the Lord whose word I praise, in God I trust without a fear. What can man do to me? What faith, what confidence this man has in his predicament. Psalm 57. To the choir master, according to Do Not Destroy, that's the name of the tune, Do Not Destroy. This is a miktam, and it was written when David fled from Saul in the cave. And in verse 4, he says that I lie in the midst of lions. You can get the cave picture here. The lions that greedily devour the sons of men, their teeth are sharp and arrows, their spears are like, their tongues are like sharp words. In verse 6, they set a net for my steps. My soul was bowed down. They dug a pit in my way, but they'd fallen into it themselves. They're hunting him down like wild animals. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens, he says. Let thy glory be over the earth. That's sandwiched between those two previous statements of how he's lying in the midst of lions and how he's being tracked down, hunted as if he were a wild beast. And yet in the midst of it, he can praise God in those words. You come to Psalm 59, again to the choir master, according to the same tune as previously. Must have been a popular tune in the Hebrew hymn book, Do Not Destroy. It's a miktam of David once again, and this one was written when Saul sent men to watch his house in order to kill him. That's the time when Michal helped him escape. Verse 3, lo, they lie in wait for my life. Fierce men band themselves against me. For no transgression or sin of mine, O Lord, for no fault of mine, they run and make ready. I haven't done any wrong to Saul, and yet he's sending these men to my house to kill me. Verse 6, each evening they come back, howling like dogs and prowling about the city. Notice the difference here. On this occasion, he was in his house, and the imagery is of dogs prowling around the city streets. In the previous psalm, he was hiding in a cave, and the imagery there concerned wild animals of the bush. So you can see how he's chosen his pictures to suit his circumstances. And you have these packs of wild dogs that scavenge around the city streets at night. That, he says, is what these people are. Coming to my house, looking through the windows and saying, when can we get him? Of course, they see him lying in bed. That's not him at all. It's only a dummy that his wife has made up in his place. Verse 7, there they are, bellowing with their mouths and snarling with their lips, for who, they think, will hear us? But thou, O Lord, dost laugh at them. Let us hold all the nations in derision. It's laughable, he says, these attacks upon me. And he goes on to speak about how God will destroy the wicked and vindicate the righteous. Then in verse 14, each evening they come back, howling like dogs, prowling about the city. They roam about for food and growl if they do not get their fill. But I will sing of thy might. And so he goes on. Some magnificent stuff in these psalms. In fact, some of the greatest of David's psalms seem to come from this period of his flight from Saul. And we've looked at a collection of them there in these psalms 52 through to 59. But this has been going on, as I said, for a number of years. And you find that after a while it takes its toll on David. And when you get towards the end of his period of flight from Saul, you almost get the impression that he's run out of strength. He's just about given up in despair. And the man who wrote those lofty psalms of faith and confidence in God starts to slip. And next week we'll look at some of David's experiences in the months that followed, in the years that followed. We enter upon a barren period, which is not enriched with psalms, and where David had to learn some very harsh lessons. But that's another story. At least we finished on a high note tonight as we've looked at these magnificent psalms of David and seen how through it all his confidence in God never wavers.